Chapter 8. Bobby. The Harmon Daejeon was a Dowager-class dreadnought, half a kilometer in length and a quarter million tons dry weight. Her interior docking bay was large enough to hold four frigate-class escort ships and a variety of lighter shuttles and repair craft. Currently, it held only two ships, the large and almost opulent shuttle that had ferried the Martian ambassadors and state officials up for the flight to Earth, and the smaller and more functional Navy shuttle Bobby had ridden up from Ganymede. Bobby was using the empty space to jog. The Daejeon's captain was being pressured by the diplomats to get them to Earth as quickly as possible, so the ship was running at a near-constant 1G acceleration. While this made most of the Martian civilians uncomfortable, it suited Bobby just fine. The Corps trained at high G all the time, and did lengthy endurance drills at 1G at least once a month. No one ever said it was to prepare for the possibility of having to fight a ground war on Earth. No one had to. Her recent tour on Ganymede hadn't allowed her to get in any high G exercise, and the long trip to Earth seemed like an excellent opportunity to get back into shape. The last thing she wanted was to appear weak to the natives. "Anything you can do, I can do better," she sang to herself in a breathless falsetto as she ran. "I can do anything better than you." She gave her wristwatch a quick glance. 2 hours. At her current leisurely pace, that meant 12 miles. Push for 20? How many people on Earth regularly ran for 20 miles? Martian propaganda would have her believe that half of the people on Earth didn't even have jobs. They just lived off the government dole and spent their meager allowances on drugs and stim parlors. But probably some of them could run for 20 miles. She'd bet Snoopy and his gang of Earther Marines could have run 20 miles, the way they were running from. "Anything you can do, I can do better," she sang, then concentrated on nothing but the sound of her shoes slapping on the metal deck. She didn't see the yeoman entering the docking bay, so when he called out to her, she twisted in surprise and tripped over her own feet, catching herself with her left hand just before she would have dashed her brains out on the deck. She felt something pop in her wrist, and her right knee bounced painfully off the floor as she rolled to absorb the impact. She lay on her back for a few moments, moving her wrist and knee to see if there was any serious damage. Both hurt, but neither had any grating sensation in it. Nothing broken, then. Barely out of the hospital, and already looking for ways to bang herself up again. The yeoman ran up to her and dropped into a crouch at her side. "Jesus, Gunny, you took a hell of a spill," the Navy boy said. "A hell of a spill." He touched her right knee where the bruise was already starting to darken the bare skin below her jogging shorts, then seemed to realize what he was doing and yanked his hand back. "Sergeant Draper, your presence is requested at a meeting in Conference Room G at 1450 hours, he said, squeaking a little as he rattled off his message. "How come you don't carry your terminal with you? They've had trouble tracking you down." Bobby pushed herself back up to her feet, gingerly testing her knee to see if it would hold her weight. "You just answered your own question, kid." Bobby arrived at the conference room 5 minutes early, her red and khaki service uniform sharply pressed and marred only by the white wrist brace the company medic had given her for what turned out to be a minor sprain. A Marine in full battle dress and armed with an assault rifle opened the door for her and gave her a smile as she went by. It was a nice smile, full of even, white teeth, below almond-shaped eyes so dark they were almost black. Bobby smiled back and glanced at the name on his suit. Corporal Matsuke. Never knew who you'd run into in the galley or the weight room. It didn't hurt to make a friend or two. She was pulled the rest of the way into the room by someone calling her name. "Sergeant Draper," Captain Thorson repeated, gesturing impatiently toward a chair at the long conference table. "Sir," Bobby said, and snapped off a salute before taking the seat. She was surprised how few people were in the room. Just Thorson from the intelligence corps and two civilians she hadn't met. "Gunny, we're going over some of the details in your report. We'd appreciate your input." Bobby waited a moment to be introduced to the two civilians in the room, but when it became clear Thorson wasn't going to do it, she just said, "Yes, sir, whatever I can do to help." The first civilian, a severe-looking red-headed woman in a very expensive suit, said, "We're trying to create a better timeline of the events leading up to the attack. Can you show us on this map where you and your fire team were when you received the radio message to return to the outpost?" Bobby showed them, then went step by step through the events of that day. Looking at the map they'd brought, she saw for the first time how far she'd been flung across the ice by the impact of the orbital mirror. It looked like it had been a matter of centimeters between that and being smashed into dust like the rest of her platoon. "Sergeant," Thorson said, his tone of voice letting her know he'd said it a couple of times before. "Sir, sorry. Looking at these photos sent me wool gathering. It won't happen again." Thorson nodded, but with a strange expression Bobby couldn't read. "What we're trying to pinpoint is precisely where the anomaly was inserted prior to the attack," the other civilian, a chubby man with thinning brown hair, said. "The anomaly," they called it now. You could hear them capitalize the word when they said it. Anomaly. Like something that just happens. A strange, random event. It was because everyone was still afraid to call it what it really was. The weapon. "So," the chubby guy said, "based on how long you had radio contact and information regarding loss of radio signal from other installations around that area, we were able to pinpoint the source of the jamming signal as the anomaly itself." "Wait," Bobby said, shaking her head. "What? The monster can't have jammed our radios. It had no tech. It wasn't even wearing a damn spacesuit to breathe. How could it be carrying jamming equipment?" Thorson patted her hand paternally, a move that irritated Bobby more than it calmed her. "The data doesn't lie, Sergeant. The zone of radio blackout moved, and always at its center was the thing, the anomaly," Thorson said, then turned away from her to speak to the chubby guy and the redhead. Bobby sat back, feeling the energy move away from her in the room, like she was the one person at the dance without a date. But since Thorson hadn't dismissed her, she couldn't just leave. Redhead said, "Based on our radio loss data, that puts insertion here." She pointed at something on the map. "And the path to the UN outpost is along this ridge." "What's in that location?" Thorson said with a frown. Chubby pulled up a different map and pored over it for a few seconds. "Looks like some old service tunnels for the dome's hydro plant. This says they haven't been used in decades." "So," Thorson said, "the kind of tunnels one might use to transport something dangerous that needs to be kept secret." "Yes," Redhead said. "Maybe they were delivering it to that marine outpost and it got loose. The Marines cut and ran when they saw it was out of control." Bobby gave a dismissive laugh before she could stop herself. "You have something to add, Sergeant Draper?" Thorson said. Thorson was looking at her with his enigmatic smile, but Bobby had worked with him long enough to know that what he hated most was bullshit. If you spoke up, he wanted to make sure you actually had something useful to say. The two civilians were looking at her with surprise, as though she were a cockroach that had suddenly stood up on two legs and started speaking. She shook her head. "When I was a boot, you know what my drill sergeant said was the second most dangerous thing in the solar system after a Martian marine?" The civvies continued to stare at her, but Thorson nodded and mouthed the words along with her as she next spoke. "A UN marine." Chubby and the redhead shared a look, and Redhead rolled her eyes for him. But Thorson said, "So, You don't think the UN soldiers were running from something that got out of their control? Not a fucking chance, sir. Then give us your take on it. That UN outpost was staffed by a full platoon of Marines, same strength as our outpost. When they finally started running, there were 6 left. 6. They fought almost to the last man. When they ran to us, they weren't trying to disengage. They were coming so we could help them continue the fight. Chubby picked a leather satchel up off the floor and started rummaging in it. Redhead watched as though what he was doing was far more interesting than anything Bobby had to say. If this were some secret UN thing that those Marines were tasked to deliver or protect, they wouldn't have come. They'd have died doing it rather than abandon their mission. That's what we would have done. Thank you, Thorson said. I mean, it wasn't even our fight, and we fought to the last Marine to stop that thing. You think the UN Marines would do less? Thank you, Sergeant, Thorson said again, louder. I tend to agree, but we have to explore all possibilities. Your comments are noted. Chubby finally found what he was looking for, a small plastic box of mints. He took one out, then held the box out to Redhead to take one. The sickly, sweet smell of spearmint filled the air. Around a mouthful of mint, Chubby said, Yes, thank you, Sergeant. I think we can proceed here without taking up more of your time. Bobby stood up, snapped another salute at Thorson, and left the room. Her heart was going fast. Her jaw ached where she was grinding her teeth. Civvies didn't get it. No one did. When Captain Martins came into the cargo bay, Bobby had just finished disassembling the gun housing on her combat suit's right arm. She removed the 3-barrel Gatling gun from its mount and placed it on the floor next to the 2 dozen other parts she'd already stripped off. Next to them sat a can of gun cleaner and a bottle of lubricant, along with the various rods and brushes she'd used to clean the parts. Martins waited until she had the gun on the cleaning mat, then sat down on the floor next to her. She attached a wire brush to the end of one of the cleaning rods, dipped it in the cleaner, and began running the brush through the gun, 1 barrel at a time. Martins watched. After a few minutes, she replaced the brush with a small cloth and swabbed the remaining cleanser out of the barrels. Then a fresh cloth soaked in gun lubricant to oil them. When she was applying lube to the complex mesh of gears that composed the Gatling mechanism and ammo feed system, Martins finally spoke. You know, he said, Thorson is naval intelligence right from the start. Straight into officer training, top of his class at the academy, and first posting at fleet command. He's never done anything but be an intelligence wonk. The last time he fired a gun was his 6 weeks as a boot 20 years ago. He's never led a fire team or served in a combat platoon. That, Bobby said, putting down her lubricant, then standing up to put the gun back together, is a fascinating story. I really appreciate your sharing it. So, Martins continued, not missing a beat, how fucked up do you have to be before Thorson starts asking me if maybe you aren't a little shell-shocked? Bobby dropped the wrench she was holding, but caught it with her other hand before it could hit the deck. Is this an official visit? Because if not, you can Me now? I'm not a wonk, Martin said. I'm a Marine. 10 years as an enlisted man before I was offered OCS. Got dual degrees in psychology and theology. The end of Bobby's nose itched, and she scratched it without thinking. The sudden smell of gun oil let her know that she'd just rubbed lubricant all over her face. Martins glanced at it, but didn't stop talking. She tried to drown him out by putting the gun together as noisily as possible. I've done combat drills, CQB training, war games, he said, speaking a little louder. Did you know I was a boot at the same camp where your father was first sergeant? Sergeant Major Draper is a great man. He was like a god to us boots. Bobby's head snapped up, and her eyes narrowed. Something about this head-shrinker acting like he knew her father felt dirty. It's true. And if he were here right now, he'd be telling you to listen to me. Fuck you, Bobby said. She imagined her father wincing at the use of obscenity to hide her fear. You don't know shit. I know that when a gunnery sergeant with your level of training and combat readiness almost gets taken out by a yeoman still at the tail end of puberty, something is goddamn wrong. Bobby threw the wrench at the ground, knocking over the gun oil, which began to spread across her mat like a bloodstain. I fucking fell down. We were at a full G, and I fell down. And in the meeting today? Yelling at two civilian intelligence analysts about how Marines would rather die than fail? I didn't yell, Bobby said, not sure if that was the truth. Her memories of the meeting had become confused once she was out of the room. How many times have you fired that gun since you cleaned it yesterday? What? Bobby said, feeling nauseated and not sure why. For that matter, how many times had you fired it since you cleaned it the day before that? Or the one before that? Stop it, Bobby said, waving one hand limply at Martin's and looking for a place to sit back down. Have you fired that gun even once since you've come on board the Daejeon? Because I can tell you that you've cleaned it every single day you've been on board, and several times you've cleaned it twice in one day. No, Bobby said, finally sitting down with a thump on an ammo canister. She had no memory of having cleaned the gun before that day. I didn't know that. This is post-traumatic stress disorder, Bobby. It's not a weakness or some kind of moral failure. It's what happens when you live through something terrible. Right now, you're not able to process what happened to you and your men on Ganymede, and you're acting irrationally because of it, Martin said, then moved over to crouch in front of her. She was afraid for a moment that he'd try to take her hand, because if he did, she'd hit him. He didn't. You're ashamed, he said, but there's nothing to be ashamed of. You're trained to be tough, competent, ready for anything. They taught you that if you just do your job and remember your training, you can deal with any threat. Most of all, they taught you that the most important people in the world are the ones standing next to you on the firing line. Something twitched in her cheek just under her eye, and Bobby rubbed at the spot hard enough to make stars explode in her vision. Then you ran into something that your training couldn't prepare you for, and against which you had no defense, and you lost your teammates and friends. Bobby started to reply and realized she'd been holding her breath. So, instead of speaking, she exhaled explosively. Martins didn't stop talking. We need you, Roberta. We need you back. I haven't been where you are, but I know a lot of people who have. And I know how to help you. If you let me. If you talk to me. I can't take it away. I can't cure you. But I can make it better. Don't call me Roberta, Bobby said so quietly that she could barely hear herself. She took a few short breaths, trying to clear her head, trying not to hyperventilate. The sense of the cargo bay washed over her, the smell of rubber and metal from her suit, the acrid competing scents of gun oil and hydraulic fluid, old and aged right into the metal, no matter how many times the Navy boys swabbed the decks. The thought of thousands of sailors and Marines passing through this same space, working on their equipment and cleaning these same bulkheads, brought her back to herself. She moved over to her reassembled gun and picked it up off the mat before the spreading pool of gun oil could touch it. No, Captain. Talking to you is not what's going to get me better. Then what, Sergeant? That thing that killed my friends and started this war? Somebody put that thing on Ganymede, she said, and seated the gun in its housing with a sharp metallic click. She gave the triple barrels a spin with her hand, and they turned with a fast, oily hiss of high-quality bearings. I'm going to find out who, and I'm going to kill them.